Dzień dobry. Don't get your hopes up. This is going to be in English. I'm sorry. It's about all the Polish I could learn in a couple of days. My name is Aaron Bertrand. I'm here to talk to you about T-SQL, some bad habits, and best practices. So why am I here? I'm the product evangelist at SQL Sentry. I've been working with SQL Server since version 6.5. Anybody go back that far? Oh yeah, we got one, all right. So I'm not the only old one in the room, good. I'm the editor of a couple of blog sites. Blog.sqlcentry.com is our team blog. We do a lot of varying SQL Server topics and then topics about our software, obviously. And then sqlperformance.com, which is one that's dedicated to performance-related topics around SQL Server. I'm a community moderator at dba.stackexchange.com. Anybody use Stack Exchange or Stack Overflow? Yeah. So if you guys are asking database questions on Stack Overflow, highly recommend checking out dba.stackexchange.com. It's the same model, just much more focused on database issues and much less competition and drama and all of that stuff. I've been an MVP since 1997. I'm on Twitter at Aaron Bertrand. Anybody on Twitter? Not too many, huh? That hasn't caught on over here. I'm not sure why. There's a hashtag on Twitter called SQL Help, pound SQL Help, and if you post a question there, you'll have 15, 20 people immediately trying to help you solve your problem. That one's pretty competitive. There are some people that try to dominate that hashtag and answer everybody's questions all at once, so there's no shortage of help available on Twitter. So a few things I want to say before I start talking. I've had a lot of feedback. I've given this session many times, and I've had a lot of feedback over the years that I kind of talk down. I kind of say, make people feel like they're doing things wrong. That's not really what I'm trying to get across. What I really like to stress with people is that just about everything on any of these slides are mistakes that I've made and that I've learned the hard way. So I'm not up here preaching and telling you you're doing it wrong. I'm just trying to help you learn the same things I did without learning them in production. Okay? Most of the slides have links to blog posts or further information. So the slide deck will be available up on blogs.sqlcentury.com after my session tomorrow. So feel free to download that. And there's plenty of additional information for each of the slides. And one thing that I want to stress is that you might not learn everything or things from every single slide in this deck, but I want to make sure that everyone takes away at least one thing that they can use in their job or in their hobby or whatever aspect they're using SQL Server. So what I'd like to ask is if anybody goes through this entire deck and doesn't learn a single thing, please come and tell me, because that means I'm not covering enough. I've only been asking that about the past 10 times I've given this session, and I've yet to have someone tell me that they didn't learn at least one thing. All right, so that's pretty important to me, and I'd like you to be honest with me. I'm a big boy, I can take it. So this is where the blogs and samples will be. I'll put this URL up again at the end of the session as well, but I just wanted to have it there, so if you wanted to write that down, or just remember it, it's not that hard. So, the first bad habit that I see quite a bit, select star. Anybody doing select star? Ever? Yeah, right. I don't buy it. So, sorry, I'm just going to take a quick drink. So, a lot of people will tell you, oh, you can't use select star because when you say select star to SQL Server, SQL Server goes to the metadata tables and it has to go do all these lookups and get all of the column names and check all of the data types. That's just not true. So if you name all of the columns in the table, SQL Server also has to go to the metadata because it has to validate that the column exists and it has to check that the data type is the right data type. Right? If you, for example, if you perform some kind of operation against a column, if you try to multiply a string, it's going to... you're going to have a compilation error, right? And it's not the use of star explicitly. So people say, well, don't use select star, just name all of the columns. Well, that doesn't do anything differently, right? The real problem here is that you have additional network traffic. Most of the time, and the whole basis of this is, almost every time you're selecting from a table, you're not requiring every single column, right? If I'm printing address labels, and that's the example I'm going to use in a minute, if I have a wide table with a whole bunch of information about a customer, and I'm printing address labels, what do I need? I need the address, I need the city, and I need the postal code, right? I don't need their social security number. I don't need their middle initial. I don't need, there are a bunch of things that I'm not going to need about that customer to print an address label. So there's no reason to use select star, and there's no reason to use select every single column in the table. There's also a problem when you're using select star inside of objects. So if you create a view and you say create view as select star from some table, and then the underlying table changes, guess what? The view doesn't change. The view maintains the old columns, and it can get extremely confusing. It can break your application. And also when you have the situation where you insert into a table and you don't use the column list on the insert side, and then you don't use the specific columns on the select side, if either of those table changes, or if either of those tables change, now your code is broken, right? And that's something that nothing's going to catch. Like the best practice advisor and static code analysis probably won't understand that the table has changed underneath that. So quick demo. Can everybody at the back see that okay? Does it look okay? Anybody having a problem? Yeah, okay, everybody's thumbs up. Okay, good. So in AdventureWorks, we're going to go in and we're going to print some address labels from the address table. But first I wanted to show you, one of the biggest reasons I see people saying I use select star is because I didn't want to type all the columns I needed. It was easier to type select star, right? And they won't say I'm lazy, but that's really what it comes down to. But something that a lot of people don't know is that if you go into Object Explorer and you go into a table, let's say person.address, there's a node here called columns, right? If you drag that columns node onto a query window, it dumps a comma-separated list of all of your columns onto the query window. How many people didn't know that? Awesome. All right. So that's half the room taken care of already. Good. So that's a quick shortcut. So if you're lazy about select star, if you're using select star because you don't want to type all the columns, I find it's much easier, even though it doesn't put it in a nice format, right? You're going to have to put some carriage returns in there and stuff. But it's much easier to drag all of the columns onto the query window once and remove the ones you don't need than it is to expand the columns list and type out all the ones that you do need. Right, so I think that is a little bit of a productivity boost. So let's compare the execution plan. If I'm printing address labels for all of my customers in Napa Valley, right, I'm going to say select star from person.address where address line 1 like Napa, or just the columns I need. Right, it's a little bit more typing. The code is a little uglier. But if you look at what happens when you run the execution plan, you see much different results. So the first one where we said select star, the cost is 72%. That's just an estimated cost. It's a guideline. It doesn't mean anything real. It doesn't mean that if this whole batch took 10 minutes, this would take 7 minutes and 20 seconds. It's nothing. It's not concrete. It's just a guideline saying, well, we estimate that this is about 72% of the cost of this entire batch. Right, so it's not something to live by. It's just a guideline. And the reason why this query was more expensive is because I performed an index seek to find all the customers that were in Napa Valley. But because I said select star and I was pulling a bunch of columns I didn't need that the index didn't cover, these columns aren't in the index. So I had to do a lookup from the clustered index to go pull all of the other columns from that. And as the you'll see in a lot of queries, the index seek will seek for a certain number of rows, and at some point, it will eventually become super expensive to perform a seek and then perform a lookup for each one of those rows that are that result from the seek. And you'll see there's this concept called a tipping point where a seek will become a scan. And because it's just too expensive to do all those bookmark lookups, it's cheaper for SQL Server to just read the whole table instead of finding the rows it needs and performing all of these lookups. On the other hand, if I just pull the columns that I need, my estimated cost is only 28% because I'm able to perform an index seek, and because the columns I requested are all in the index, I didn't need to go perform a lookup. And that's what added the huge amount of cost to the first version of the query. Now with the view, so let's say I have a very simple table with two integer columns, and I'm just going to insert one row into that table. So A is equal to 1, B is equal to 2. Easy to follow at first. I'm going to create a view that just says select star from my table dbo.x. Now, someone else, maybe me in a week that I don't remember what I did a week ago, or someone else in the company, maybe comes along and says, you know, that table has a column called B. It's the wrong name. That table, that column should actually be called C, for whatever reason. Right? I'm trying to keep the letters simple so it's not this big, long thing. But someone comes along and renames the column B to C. And then maybe a couple days later, someone says, oh, we need a date time column on that table. Let's add a column called B. We'll make it a date time, and we'll give it a default of right now. Right? So we're adding a new column called B after we rename B to C. And if you aren't confused by that, you'll understand why SQL Server is also confused by this. So if I select star from the table. Here are the columns, right? I had A and B initially were 1 and 2. I renamed B to C, so A and C, and then I added B, right? And B has the date time in it. And if I select from the view still says that B is an integer, and it doesn't have any idea what C is. You can fix that. There's a command called sp refresh view. There's also a refresh SQL module. But the person who changes the underlying table has to know that all of the that there are views out there that use select star. And there's no way for them to know that. What I suggest people do usually is to create all of their views with schema binding. And that makes it a little more work when you have to change the table. But it forces the user who is changing the table to at least understand that there are views out there that reference the table. And it prevents them from changing them until they also change the view. So you have to remove schema binding from the view, change the view, and put schema binding back on. Right. So if I refresh the view, and I select star from the view again, now it looks just like the select from the table. Right. So select star in a view is bad. If you want to prevent people from using select star against the table, you can add a computed column that tries to do a divide by zero. This is a little trick I learned from Remus, who works at Microsoft. So if I add that column to the table, and then I select star from dbo.x, I get a nice ugly error. And no results. So anybody who tries to use select star is going to have an error at runtime. All right. So that's select star. Anybody who didn't raise their hand when they actually do use select star, your hand's a little lower now, I hope. All right, specifying length and precision and scale. So any type of variable length data type, varchar, char, var binary, decimal, numeric, all of these data types take parameters for length or precision and scale, and they're optional. So I see a lot of code where people are doing things like this, where they say, well, I'm going to declare this string and just say varchar, and I'm not going to declare length because, I don't really care what the length is. It doesn't really matter. Right? So in a case like this, where I've set my first name to the, I've set the variable equal to my first name. And you'll probably be surprised at what the results of this query will be. So, what happened to my name? Where did my data go? I just lost four characters of data in the first and third portions of this query. So when I just selected the variable directly, it only returned A. Can anybody tell me what happened to the other four characters? No? So in some cases, when you declare a variable or a column or a parameter without a length, it will default to a varchar 1. In other cases, it will default to a varchar 30. I'm not going to tell you which cases work where, because I don't want you to memorize them and not bother when you know your string is less than 30 characters. Right? But you need to be careful about this, because it gets even worse. So this is just a silly query where I'm just returning data to the screen, and I can see right away that I had a problem. Right? I know right away that I lost four letters in my name in two of these results. But what if I have a stored procedure that takes varchar with no length as a parameter? And I've seen this, and I've helped customers troubleshoot this problem. So I'm going to create this procedure, and I'm going to pass two strings that are obviously much longer than five characters, right? And in the output, this procedure just prints the two strings. Go away. Right? That's all the store procedure does. But imagine this store procedure inserts data into a table. So I just called the store procedure with a string that is longer than 30 characters, and it turned out to be one character. Now I inserted that data into a table. My unit test passed because the store procedure didn't error. I deploy the code to production. The code runs. A bunch of data gets into the table. Every instance of every string in that column is one character because the store procedure parameter truncated it with no error message, no warning, and that information is not logged. So guess what? It's gone. It doesn't exist. It never existed. Those characters are all just thrown out into space. Right? So there's no way to recover from this because unless you log every single store procedure call into your system, right, with all of the parameter values. So that's pretty important. Now, there are some cases where you will get an error, so you don't have to worry that this is always the case, but I would still be very careful. So if I have a table and my column is declared as varchar or nvarchar with no length, and I try to insert more characters, I should get this absolutely useless string or binary data would be truncated error. All right, moving on. The wrong data type. I see this stuff all the time. I could probably put a list of 500 things on here. People doing the wrong things with data in SQL Server. People will try to store strings store dates as strings or as numbers. Microsoft, terrible for this. A SQL Server agent. Anybody look at the sysjob history table? It's got date and time as an integer, separate, in two separate integer columns. Like, why? I don't know why they did that. So one of the most common reasons I see for people to do this is they want to store date and time as their own regional format. So you guys love DDMMYY. I agree with you 100%. I think the American way to do this is stupid. MDY makes no sense. But the point is, when you store date time data in SQL Server, you get a bunch of benefits. You get validation that it's actually a date. You get date time operations. You get to index that column and use date range queries to find specific ranges and be able to use a seek to get the data that you want. When you change that and you store it as your favorite format of string, you lose all of that, especially the indexability and the sortability. So if you try to order by a column where you've stored it as DMY, you're going to get all the firsts of all the months of all time, and then all the seconds of all the months of all time, and then all the thirds. Doesn't make any sense. And you can't do a range query on that either. You have to explicitly convert it to a date time to get any benefit out of that data type. Some other instances, date time, when date or small date time will do. I find that people will put date time across all of their enterprise, even though in some cases they don't store any time and they don't care about time, or they don't care about sub-minute granularity. Disk, I always have this argument with people, but disk space is cheap. I don't care if it takes 8 bytes instead of 3 or 4. But you should, because even though disk space is cheap and SSDs are fast, we still have bottlenecks in memory. And every byte that you waste in memory is not good. I mean, unless your database fits entirely in memory, okay, go nuts. But if your database is bigger than memory, you want to conserve as many bytes as possible in all of the rows of all of your tables, because every time you pull data in and out of memory, that's expensive, right? So the less waste you have there, the better off you'll be. Some other examples here, too. One of my favorites is people that use max types for URLs and email addresses. So there are standards that define how long a URL can be and how long an email address can be. There's no reason to use max there. Email address is a max of 320 characters. You can't have an email address that longer than that. And if you have an address that long, I'd love to talk to you afterward, because that's just dumb. So people use these max types for these things, and there's a bunch of extra overhead with max, and it just seems to be like a laziness to determine what should the max length be. Well, people could put in anything, so let's just make it a max. Well, it's expensive to make something a max when it doesn't need to be. All right, schema prefix. How many people use DBO dot when they reference all of their tables? How many people don't use DBO dot when they reference all of their tables? Okay, I hope to change some minds here. All right. It's very important to always use the DBO prefix. So for one, when other people are reading your code, there's no confusion. So I don't have to wonder, oh, he's referencing the employees table. Which one is that? Maybe you have multiple. Maybe you have a DBO dot. Maybe you have a test dot. Maybe you have a staging dot. It's very important to reference that just for human sake. SQL Server also has to work a little bit harder. If you say select star from employees, what it's going to do, it's going to check your default schema first for an object called employees. Then it's going to go look at DBO as a fallback. So there's an extra little hit there. Not something you'll ever notice in production code, but it's still, it's a wasted lookup. The most important part, though, is that it can yield multiple plans for the same query. So two people run the exact same query, and you end up wasting plan cache space with two identical plans. Right. So quick demo of that. I'm going to free the procedure cache. I don't think I'm planning any tricks on you. I'm going to create two users without login. This is just a quick way to create users in a database without having to go create logins and passwords and all of that. And I'm going to set their default schemas to two different things. So one of them is going to have a default schema of sales, and the other one's going to have a default schema of person. I'm going to create a very simple table and grant them both select access on the table. And oh my, never type in a demo, but oh, this hurts. Sorry. All right, that'll work now. Okay. Now, these batches are identical, right? So you're going to have to take my word for it that I copied and pasted this exact SQL query text down here, and I'm just executing as two users. For anybody who ever gets the password for a user so they can log in and impersonate them and run queries as if they were them, execute as user is very powerful. It doesn't work in all scenarios, but it's a good way for limited within the context of a single database, testing of any user in that database. Right. So I'm going to run as these two users, and this is going to produce no rows because I didn't enter any data into the tables, but they're going to run the exact same query. Now, if I go look in the plan cache, and these don't memorize these queries. The sample code will be up on the blog site tomorrow as well. I'm going to look in the plan cache for all of the versions of all of the plans that we have that have a simple table in the query text. Now, I know that that the only things that are going to be in there are the things that I just did because I cleared the procedure cache at the beginning of the demo. So if I take a look at that, I have two copies of the query text. They're exactly identical. They're 32K each, and they were each used once. So because of, well, I'll tell you why in a second, but if we go back up and run the demo again, I'm going to clear the procedure cache. I'm going to type in a demo again, like a bad guy. dbo dot. I'll run this batch again. And then we'll take a look at the plan cache again. And we'll see that now we have one version of the plan in cache. So I just halved the space requirement in the plan cache for this query. And it was used twice. So we get plan reuse. That's good. We want our different users that are writing the exact same query to have the same reuse the same plan. OK. Blind assumptions. I see tons of these out on Stack Overflow, the MSDN forums, everywhere. People will try to optimize a query. They say, I have a scan. I want it to be a seek. They're doing select from table with no where clause. And they want a seek for some reason. So seek is not always the best way to satisfy the query that you have. Sometimes a scan is the most efficient way for SQL Server to return the data. So don't think that it, just because you see a scan in the execution plan, you have this mantra to turn it into a seek. It's not always the case. Non-clustered index. Sometimes a non-clustered index is better than the clustered index. People say, well, I ran this query and I only got an index seek. I really want a clustered index seek. Well, clustered index is almost always going to be wider than the non-clustered index. So typically, if your query can satisfy the results by using a skinnier non-clustered index, that's better. So don't always think that because the clustered index isn't part of the plan, that that's a bad thing. People think that a heap is always inferior to a clustered index. They say that every single table has to have a clustered index. And in some cases, you have to have clustered indexes. I think in Azure SQL Database, when it first started out, you couldn't create a heap table. Everything had to be a clustered index. Heaps do have their use cases. So don't assume that because you see a heap that it absolutely has to have a clustered index. There might be a very good reason why it's a heap. Cursors. Usually cursors are bad. Usually cursors come from a row-by-row object-oriented programming mindset where you think you have to deal with every single thing one row at a time, right? And usually that's not the case. Usually SQL Server is better at performing set-based operations, but not always. There are some situations where a cursor is better. Running totals, for example. If you're on a version of SQL Server lower than SQL Server 2012, the most efficient supported option is a cursor to establish running totals. Dynamic SQL, same thing. Sometimes dynamic SQL is the right way to solve a problem. I have a video up on SQLcentury.tv about the kitchen sink procedure. If you do a search for the kitchen sink procedure, I'm pretty sure it'll be the first hit. And what that is when you have 15 optional parameters that come in where you can search by first name or last name or customer ID or total amount sold, and you build this gigantic where clause that has a bunch of ors in it that says where the column is equal to the parameter or the parameter is null, or this column is equal to the parameter or the parameter is null, and you have this big long plan and you expect SQL Server to do something useful with that. Well, it can't, because the first time, if you have a bare query like that, the first time you pass in a set of parameters, it's going to cache a plan for that set of parameters. So search by last name is not necessarily going to produce a plan that works for a search by total order count. So sometimes the best option there is to build the SQL dynamically depending on which parameters were passed in. And that makes it easier for SQL Server to optimize a plan for that specific parameter. Right? So you use up more space in the plan cache, but that's OK, right? Because you're going to get more efficient queries for the most part. Sometimes option recompile is worth the cost. People think, oh, well, I don't want to use option recompile. I would rather get a crappy execution plan and run slowly than use up 5 milliseconds of CPU time doing a compile. And sometimes option recompile is actually better. And sometimes SQL Server will change the output order on you. I have a slide coming up about order. A lot of people make assumptions about the default order of a table. If I insert a bunch of rows into a table and I do a select, they're going to come out in the order I inserted. And that's not true. Right, so order by. One of the things I see a lot, and this is OK in ad hoc code, and I do it all the time in ad hoc code, order by 3. Order by 2 desk. People do that because they know they have these 3 columns in the select list, and they want to order by the last one. That's OK for ad hoc stuff. If you're running stuff in Management Studio, and you're just checking out data, whatever, please don't put that in production code. Because inevitably, what's going to happen, and I've seen this happen many times, someone will come in and add a column to the beginning of the select list, and now the application is broken because it doesn't order in the way that users expect, right? And then the natural order thing. So without order by, there's no guaranteed order. And I'm going to demonstrate this, why you can't rely on this. That has nothing to do with, you know, your query. Even if you have a clustered index, even if you inserted all the rows in the order that you want them to be, if you just run a select without an order by, there's no guarantee that you'll get the same order every time. It could change tomorrow. It could change based on, there are probably 100 factors that can change how SQL Server determines to return that data to you if you don't specify with an order by. There's also an assumption that I see a lot that top and order by in a view or a CTE or a derived table or a subquery will dictate the outer order. So it's not true. What the order by, if you have order by where it's allowed in a subquery or a CTE or a view, what that's doing is you'll notice that you can't do that unless you add a top. So people add top 100% as a kludge to say, well, I need to have a top, but I want all the rows, so I'm going to say select top 100%. So what SQL Server does when it sees that, it throws the top and the order by away, because the order by is not in a subquery is not used for presentation order. It's used for determining which top rows to include. And when you say top 100%, SQL Server is smart and says, oh, well, you're including all the rows, so I don't need the order by to determine which rows to include. You're including all of them, so it doesn't matter, right? So the order by has to be on the outer query for it to make any sense in that situation. All right, so a quick example of this. So a very simple table. DBO.what has an ID column that's an integer, which is a primary key, and a name column, which is a Unicode NVARCHAR 64. I'm going to insert three rows, not in any particular order, actually intentionally out of order, right? So KFA 132. And if I just select ID and name from DBO.what, they come back as 123, right? So not in the order that I inserted, but rather in the order of the clustered index. And people say, oh, well, then it will always come back in the order of the clustered index, right? Because that's the primary key column. It's the clustered index. So that's the way the data is physically sorted on disk. So whenever I run this query, I'm always going to get 123. Except someone comes along. Maybe I don't even know they did this, right? Someone comes along and uses the database tuning advisor, and it says, oh, you should have this index on this table. So they go ahead and do it. They create an index on the name column. Now I'm going to run the exact same query. And oh, what happened? It's not 123 anymore. But I didn't change anything that I know of, right? I didn't know that someone created that index. I didn't change my query, and I still got one. Now I get the data in a different order. It's actually ordered by the name alphabetically, right? So if you expect a certain order, don't rely on an assumption of what you saw, or don't rely on observations, right? If you need a certain order or you expect a certain order, make it so, and add an order by to the query. So this is just proof that back in SQL Server 2000, if you did this, you put select top 100% order by inside of a view, and then you selected from the view without an order by, it would return the data in the order of the order by. 2005 fixed that. That wasn't a feature, that was a bug. Right. So I'm creating a view that's ordered by ID, but when I select from the view, it still returns the order from that I got before with the order by name. And the reason that that happens, by the way, is that the even though both the clustered index and the non-clustered index support the query, and both can provide an index scan on the data, SQL Server can, if they're both exactly the same, SQL Server just flips a coin, and it could choose either. So for whatever reason, tomorrow, it could go back to the clustered index order, right? Because they're roughly the same cost, the clustered index and the non-clustered index, in this case, because I only have two columns in the table. So the only way to guarantee the order by it doesn't matter if the order by is inside the view or not, but I have to specify it outside of the view in order to guarantee that. All right. Date range queries. So this date ranges are one of my favorite topics. So I see all kinds of sins here. One is applying year, date add, convert, all of these expressions to columns in a table. So I want to find all the orders for March of last year. Okay, where year of order date is equal to 2015 and month of order date is equal to 3. That's easy, right? Nice and easy query. Except it's not efficient, because if order date has an index, I could have found those rows much more efficiently. When I say year and month against that column, SQL Server has to scan, because it has to perform that computation against every value in the table. If you have a big orders table, that's going to be quite expensive. Shorthand, anybody use getDate plus one? GetDate minus one to find today or yesterday, or I'm sorry, tomorrow or yesterday? Yeah, so that's going to change. Another thing is these shorthand, when pass into date add or date diff, or date part, I guess, for some of them. Maybe all of them. Yeah, so date, but usually I see this with date add or date diff. People will type date add and then they'll just type D instead of day, even though typing day would have taken an extra half a microsecond, right? And make the code more self-documenting. So I'd like to know if anybody in the audience thinks that they know all of the shorthand initials and know what they stand for. Does anybody think they know all of them? Nobody does. Okay, good. All right. So yesterday in my pre-con, I had to call someone out because they said, yeah, I know them all, and I fooled them. So that was fun. I felt bad, but. Between. Anybody use between for date range queries? I want to find all the rows for February, so I say between February 1st and February 28th at 2359.59.997. People are doing that? Yeah, okay. We'll talk about that too. And regional date format. So I talked earlier about the DMY and MDY. These are actually the only two safe formats you can use in SQL Server. YYYYMMDD without the dashes, and YYYYMMDD with the dashes and with the time. And this T is very important, and I will show you why. Okay. This went off screen for some reason. All right, so this is bad because it resized my screen a little bit. So these are the typical tricks that people use to find the end of a period, right, or the end of a day. They take the day after that and they subtract 3 milliseconds, right? For date time, that works, right? You want the 2359.59.997. So just to show that what this shows is what I'm finding here is yesterday and the end of yesterday. So I'm just pretend that I'm passing in parameters to get the to get a report that shows me all of the data for yesterday. Right? So that's yesterday at midnight, and the end is, I should have given those columns names, but the end is yesterday at 2359.59.997. The problem is, if the stored procedure parameter changes, or someone's variable declaration changes, or the underlying data type of the table changes to one of the other date-time data types, you're going to have problems. So if the parameter changes to small date time, now suddenly I'm saying between May 16th at midnight and May 17th at midnight. Well, guess what? That could include data from the next day. That between is no longer valid, it's no longer accurate. There might not be much data for that day, but it depends on how you store your data. Sometimes people will store a lot of data in bulk with no timestamp, but take real-time orders with a timestamp. So you might actually have a lot of data that's timestamped at midnight. What about if I convert to date? If the parameter is date for whatever reason, someone decided, oh, we'll use date for the parameters, we'll change the table later. Well, that rounds down, so the date time data is still has time associated with it, but my date range is now between May 16th and May 16th. Well, guess what? That's not going to find any data from after midnight on May 16th. What if you have date time 2? Anybody using date time 2 yet? So date time 2 has slightly better granularity than date time. What that means is you could potentially have data in your table that's timestamp 2359.59.998. Right? Which is greater than 2359.9966667. So you could miss data. Now, it's not going to be much data, but you want your report to be accurate, right? So always greater than or equal to the start and less than the day after the end. So if you're trying to find a report for February, I want all of February's data. Don't use between February 1st and February, whatever you think the end of February is. An EO month, by the way, terrible. Don't use it because it finds the end of the month at midnight, not the end of the month at 2359.59, whatever. So between for that also doesn't work. But it's very easy for February, for example, to say greater than or equal to February 1st and less than March 1st. Now, no matter what the data type is, for the incoming parameters, for the variables, for the data type underlying in the table, you're always going to get accurate data, right? So, and you can, it's always very easy to use date add to get the beginning of the next range, right? So I can, if I say I'm looking for all of February, so it's very easy to find the beginning of February, right? I can find February 1st very easily, and then I just add a month and say greater than or equal to the beginning and less than the beginning of the next range, whether that's a day or a week or a month or whatever it is. All right, so this is the quiz that I caught someone out on yesterday, and it almost fits on the screen. All right, so date part W, how many people think that date part of W is 21, or for today's date? Anybody think it's 21? Okay, so we got one ISO week guy, all right. And how many people think it's 20? Nobody. Were you guys talking about my pre-con yesterday? Oh, we have one, okay, good. And how many people think it's 3? How many people are not breathing? Okay. Well, we'll skip that then. Okay, how about Y? This one's a little bit easier, I think. How many people think that date part Y, notice it's not Y, but just date part Y is 16? Got a few. Good. How many people think it's 138? We got 2. And 2016? All right, can we get gas masks or oxygen for the rest of you? Because, all right, so this is going to surprise probably most of the people who are sleeping when they wake up. Date part W does not stand for week. It stands for day of week. And because I have US English settings, my first day of week is Sunday, so today's Tuesday, it's day 3. Date part Y. Y is not year, it's day of year. Today's the 138th day of the year. So, my point here is, don't use shorthand. Just spell it out. How much harder is it to type day of week or year than W or Y? It's very easy. Makes your code self-documenting and prevents you from getting caught out in presentations like mine. All right, so the plus one and minus one, folks, works great with date time. No problem, right? I'm going to declare a variable as date time, set it equal to today and or right now, and then add one and see what we get. Yes, that's tomorrow at 9 o'clock Boston time. Sorry, I change my phone's time zone when I come over here, but I don't change my computer. What happens if I change my column to be a date or a date time too? Not good. So you could have code out there in stored procedures right now that says column plus 1, column minus 1, column minus 7 without using explicit date add, and it's going to break. And guess how hard it is to find in your code column plus one. How are you going to search and find all of these? Good luck. That's not something that's going to be easy to find until it actually breaks, right? All right, so for date formats. So here are a few formats that I see people commonly use. year, month, day with dots, month slash date slash year, and then the ISO format without the T, okay? So no problem. In all of these cases, on my system, these return September 8th. What happens if I send my code to someone who, I don't know, has their language set to French because they like their error messages to be in French? All three of those now return August 9th. And that's okay if my day is greater than 12, because I'll get an error, right? But when this is a bigger problem than getting an error message. Getting an error message and you immediately realize what's going on. What if I'm inserting this data into a table? I've just inserted August 9th for all of these dates when what I typed was supposed to be September 8th. SQL Server looked at it and said, oh, because you're using the French language, I'm going to interpret your date this way. I don't understand the YYYYDDMM. I don't know anybody in France who would ever type a date that way, but this is the way SQL Server is currently coded. These two formats, always safe. Right? YYYYMMDD, no dashes, or with the dashes and the time and the T. And that's the only difference between this one and this one is the T. Everything else is identical. Right? And even in French language, I get the right dates, September 8th. Okay? So be very careful about those regional formats. Those are the only two that are safe to use, YYYYMMDD and that big long thing. All right, merge. Anybody using merge? Oh boy. All right. So, yeah, merge turns two statements or three statements into one, kind of. So, what really happens under the scenes is it still does it the way that you used to write it. The reason that's important is because without using explicit hold lock or being in serializable isolation level, you're still subject to race conditions. You're still subject to conflicts, so there can still be problems there. And most people don't know that. I bet, for everybody who used merge, can you raise your hands again? All right, now how many of you, keep your hands up, how many of you are using hold lock on the target table every time? We've got a few that know this, okay, good. The rest of you, you better go back and check your code and make sure that, test it under high concurrency, because I bet you have opportunity for race conditions. There's also a little side effect thing. If you have triggers, if you have a trigger on a table and you use merge against the trigger or against the table, and the trigger uses add at row count. So let's say you have a separate, and they could be separate triggers, an insert trigger, an update trigger, a delete trigger. And let's say your merge statement inserts three rows, deletes four rows, and updates two. All of those triggers, if you use if add at row count is greater than zero, to do something, all of those triggers will return 9. They return the sum of the operations, not the individual ones. So you have a trigger for insert, it will return all of the inserts plus all of the deletes plus all of the updates. And that's okay if you have all three and you're just testing, greater than zero in order to determine if you should do something or not. But what happens if you don't have any deletes, but your trigger is coded to do something if add at row count is greater than zero, and then you go and do stuff even though no deletes actually happened. Right, so that's a little problematic. If you search for merge with caution SQL Server, thank you. If you search merge with caution SQL Server, you'll find this URL, and I explain there are a bunch of bugs. Merge can allow incorrect results, and it can allow foreign key violations to happen without any error message. Right, so it's pretty important. Old-style joins, nobody's using old-style joins anymore, right? Outer or inner? Okay, good. Yeah, the thing I don't like about inner joins from table 1, comma, table 2, is that it's very easy to mix up the join criteria and the filter criteria. Don't default to cursors. Sometimes it can be difficult to think set-based. Don't write cursor operations by default. Instead, try to work out a set-based solution. It's not always bad. It's not always the worst way to do things. And for some things, it doesn't matter, like maintenance tasks. But I find that a lot of people just go straight into cursors when cursor wasn't ever required. If you are using cursors, the default's very heavy-handed. So don't say declare C cursor 4 and write your query. Add local fast forward. So a very simple query here. I just have a variable that's going to be an iterator, and then a DateTime2 variable to keep track of time. And I'm just selecting a bunch of data from sys.objects and cross-joining to itself in order to create enough data to make the demo worthwhile. Open the cursor, fetch the variable into it, and then just while the cursor is running, I'm just appending a string with an empty string. So it's not really doing anything. And then I close and deallocate the cursor, and I check the time. All right, so we'll see how long this takes. I'm going to take a drink. Because I can. Should be 12 seconds. Oh, 13 seconds. All right, so 13 and a half seconds to just iterate through that cursor because I had the default options. Now, if I add local fast forward, which I can do because most of the time when you're writing a cursor, you're going through one at a time, and you're operating on each row once, and then you're exiting. You're not scrolling forward, you're not scrolling backward, you're not performing updates, you're just using the cursor as a fire hose, right? Now, if I add those options and take away all those the heavy locking and the things that the cursor does by default, 3.5 seconds. So I just cut my execution time by 75%, roughly, right? Just by adding those two options. So if you have a bunch of cursors in your code, please go back and add local fast forward in all the cases where it works. All right, we're getting near the end. Case coalesce in a subquery. I'm not going to show the demo of this. You're going to have to take my word for it. When I have coalesce, select something, select max, select count from some other table, and I coalesce it with zero, what that actually expands to is a case expression that says select case when select blah, blah, blah is greater than zero, then select blah, blah, blah. That's not efficient. So what this actually does, and if you look at the execution plan, you will see that this is executed twice, this subquery. It's not the case if you use isNull instead of coalesce. For some reason, SQL Server decided to optimize isNull but not coalesce. Right? So that's the only case I'll ever recommend isNull over coalesce is if you have a subquery. Consistent formatting. So begin and end, please, and carriage returns and indents. I see people post code all the time that says create procedure dbo dot whatever as begin, set no count on, select foo from table where, and it just goes on and on and on. And I know I just stepped off camera. I think that's funny. But if you have to scroll horizontally to read code, you failed. I think that's bad. It's bad enough that we have to scroll horizontally because code is long. I don't want it to be long and wide. So please, lots of carriage returns. Semicolons, please use semicolons at the end of all of your statements. In some point in the future, you won't be able to write a statement in SQL Server without a semicolon. And if you have conventions, I don't care what they are, lowercase keywords, uppercase keywords, four spaces, tabs, indents, whatever. Just pick something and stick to it, and get your team to buy in and stick to it as well. Case and spacing, so a very important thing about query text. I'm not going to do the demo because I'm going to run out of time, but what can happen is when you have query text and you compile an execution plan, what SQL Server does is it converts your query text to binary. So every single white space, every casing difference is important. What happens is you end up with multiple plans for queries that look the same, and they're only different because one person used a tab and the other one used four spaces. Abusing count. So if you are trying to find out if there's at least one row that does something, don't do this. Don't say select count from table where whatever is greater than zero. Use exists, because what happens is, in the first case, you don't care what the number is. You just care if it's zero or not, right? So you don't care if it's 32 or 600,000. You just want to know if one row exists. The second case, if you say if exists, select from table where, it's going to exit as soon as it finds the first row. So it doesn't bother scanning the entire table to get a count. If you're looking at total count, I see a lot of people saying, oh, well, I'll just run select count star from table. That should be fast, right? Well, maybe. It's much faster to use the DMVs. And people say, oh, but the DMVs are not transactionally consistent, right? Because sometimes they're out of date because transactions are in flight. Well, if you need an absolute accurate count to the microsecond of what's in the table, what are you doing? You're saying select count star from table. That locks the table. So you have a bunch of transactions that are coming in. If your system is busy enough, right, and you're worried about the accuracy of the count, you have a bunch of transactions that are trying to do stuff while you're reading the table. So you get your count. As soon as you finish and get your count, say it's 100,000, then 200 transactions come in and change your count. So how accurate was your count? You didn't get any value by getting a super accurate count because data is always changing. And if your data is not changing, then sys.partitions is accurate enough. Okay. No lock. Anybody using no lock? Yeah, so this is a magic pixie dust turbo button. I have a great demo of this, of what happens. I hope to do this quickly enough to demonstrate. So everybody knows you can read the same row twice, right, with no lock? You can skip rows. You can read a row that never existed. So someone can insert a row, you can read it, and then they can roll it back, so it never happened. And you can there's an error, could not scan due to data movement. But there's an interesting case where you can actually get a value in a single column that never existed. So Paul White came up with this example, and it's kind of amazing. So I'm creating a table with a varchar max column. That's kind of important. I'm inserting a simple row with 16,100 X's, okay? And again, you'll be able to download this demo and try it out for yourself. So in this case, I'm going to take this code into another session. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to read the value from the table with no lock. And then I'm going to check and make sure that the beginning of the string is the same as the end of the string. And if it's not, I'm going to print the left 10 characters and the right 10 characters and exit. Okay? And that's in a loop, and it'll break as soon as it hits that condition. So it's running. Where did my query go? Here we go. All right, now, in this window, I've created two variables. One's all x's and one's all y's, and I'm just going to alternate in a loop, updating the value to be all x's and all y's, all x's, all y's. All right, pretty straightforward. And my other query quit already. Because what happens is SQL Server writes the data, starts writing the data to one page, and maybe I read it. I read that page already. It writes the data, and then I read the next page, and it has the old value, because it's a varchar max, so it's spread across multiple pages. So with no lock, you can actually read two different pages from two completely different transaction scopes. So that's not good. Stay employed. SQL Server doesn't have a Control Z button. There's no undo. If you say delete from table and you forget the where clause, you're restoring from backups if you have backups. Okay. So otherwise, keep your resume fresh, because that's the next step. Mladen, I'm not going to say his last name, Mladen's SSMS Tools Pack, it's an add-in for SQL Server, for Management Studio. What it allows you to do is change your new query template. And what I use that for is, what I do is I have my new query always say begin transaction, and then I comment out commit and rollback. And my cursor goes in the middle. So what happens is if I fire up that Management Studio quickly and I type some query and I hit execute and I see the row count and I'm like, oh, I did the wrong thing. I deleted the whole table instead of two rows. I can highlight rollback transaction and hit execute, right? And that rolls back the mistake I just made. But be careful, because you could also begin transaction, delete one row from some table, and then go on vacation and forget to commit, which is probably just as bad. So, all right, so that's all I have. There's plenty more. If you search for Bad Habits Revival SQL Server, you'll find I have a whole table. I organized all of my bad habits and best practices tips into one URL, so you should be able to find them all there. And again, the slide deck and the sample code that I have here will be available on blogs.sqlcentury.com tomorrow. So thank you very much for coming. I appreciate it.